Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's The Ancients on History Hit. I'm Tristan Hughes, your host, and in today's episode, well, we're talking about the end of the Ice Age in Britain and what happened next. Now, roughly 12 to 11,000 years ago, Britain entered a period known as the Mesolithic or Middle Stone Age. It's commonly referred to as a time of hunter-gatherer communities that roamed across Britain. And this period lasted for several thousand years before the introduction of farming and the start of the following Neolithic in around 4,000-3,500 BC. But what do we know about Mesolithic Britain and its people? Well, the surviving archaeology is quite sparse, but there is one site that has revealed an incredible amount. It's called Star Car, dating to roughly 9,000 BC. Situated in North Yorkshire, in the Vale of Pickering, Star Car's waterlogged soils have allowed organic Mesolithic artifacts to survive. There's evidence of wood carving, of antler cutlets, and so much more. This was a Mesolithic lakeside settlement. To explain, all our guests today are the archaeologists Dr. Nick Overton and Dr. Barry Taylor, who have both conducted extensive research not just on Star Car, but also nearby Mesolithic sites in the Vale of Pickering, such as No Name Hill. I really do hope you enjoy. Here's Nick, and here's Barry.
Nick, Barry, it is wonderful to have you both on the podcast today.
Hello, nice to be here.
Yeah, lovely to be here.
Now, Mesolithic Britain, just post Ice Age Britain. This is a really exciting topic. I'm so happy that we got both of you on to talk about this, because Star Car, this is an exciting site that gives us an amazing insight into life in Britain immediately after the Ice Age.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. And it's held this really pivotal place in the study of the Mesolithic in Britain, really, as well. It's the first site that was discovered where not only did you have stone tools, but you had really large assemblages of animal bone, of objects made of bone and antler, and a material that also preserves evidence for the environment. So it's the first time that any archaeologists were able to try and reconstruct aspects of not just a sort of Mesolithic life on a small scale, but fit it into sort of the changing environments of the time. So the site was originally excavated by a guy called Graham Clark. It was actually discovered a few years earlier by an archaeologist based in Scarborough called John Moore. Clark, at that time, he was a lecturer in archaeology at Cambridge. He'd just done this PhD, basically in British Mesolithic, which at that time consisted mostly of stone tools. And I think by the end of his PhD, as all of us are, he was just so bored with the subject of his own PhD, which was stone tools. And he was working, he's also had lots of contacts with people on the continent as well. And he was aware of these excavations that had been going on in sort of Scandinavia and northern Germany in peat bog sites, which, because of the nature of the peat that accumulates around these sites, so they're ancient wetlands that have filled up with this organic sediment called peat. That sediment preserves organic materials, so bone, antler, wood, plant remains, so you can not only see what people are making out of plants, you can also reconstruct the environments. And he was aware of all these excavations, and I think he just looked at Britain and just went, oh God, this is boring. Like, I just need something more. So he sort of set out really to find a site that had this levels of organic preservation so that he could trial, I think, the methods he was seeing done on the continental mainland in Northern Europe. And so there's this really famous quote in his excavation report from Star Car where he talks about receiving this package of flints from John Moore, who said, oh, I've just found this site. And he just talks about his excitement of realizing when he looks at the flint tools, he can tell that they're early Mesolithic. So he goes up to Yorkshire, meets John Moore. John Moore has already put, at Clark's request, a small trench at the side of one of the field boundaries at Star Car, where he could see the pieces of animal bone and antler eroding into the edge of this sort of field drain that was being cut through the peat. And I think Clark describes them as looking a bit like old slippers. But then he goes out and basically over 3 years digs these series of large trenches into what would have been the edge of this ancient lake through these peat deposits. And he just finds this absolutely amazing assemblage of animal bone. He's got objects made of antlers, particularly these projectile points made of pieces of red deer antler that have got like a sort of barbs along the edges, these headdresses, or certainly what they call red deer antler frontlets, so modified red deer skulls. The antlers have been cut down. And yeah, he assumed these have been worn. He's got lots of stone tools. He's got what he thinks is a platform at the edge of the lake. It's just everything he wanted was there in these trenches. And he published the site very quickly. He worked, I mean, Nick will tell you more, but he really revolutionized the idea of integrating the study of the animal bones with the stone tool assemblages. He had Sir Harry Godwin and Donald Walker, who were the sort of pioneering archaeobotanists of the time, who were using the plant material to reconstruct not just the environment around Star Car, but also around the whole of this landscape, tie it into this really early sort of really developing sequence of how the environment had changed at the end of the last ice age. And it was really incredible. And he publishes it within a few years, really. I think he puts most of us to shame. He'd publish it within about 3 years, this amazing account of life at Star Car. And it just set the scene for really how the Mesolithic, certainly the early Mesolithic of England, was really understood for the rest of the 20th century, really.
It is such a jewel of an archaeological site. I mean, Nick, how rare is it to have a site surviving with so much extraordinary archaeology dating back to this time, some 11,000 years ago?
So when, as Barry said, Clark was doing his PhD, which was published in 1932, there really weren't any early Mesolithic sites with any animal bone recovered at all. So it was all stone tools. And Clark was trying to sort of explore what you could say about people in the past with stone tools, but he was really desperate for a site with organic preservation. You can see it at the end of his PhD that he's got an appendix, and the appendix is just a one sheet page, and it's got an illustration of a barbed antler point. It's known as the Calinda Point, and it's a point that has been dredged up off the North Seabed by a fishing trawler called the Calinda, where apparently the captain of the boat pulled up the fishing nets, and there was a lump of what they describe as moor log, which is one of the peat deposits that are now on the floor of the North Sea, but would have once been terrestrial, sort of like wetland landscapes when the sea levels were much lower and all of the North Sea was Doggerland, the land connecting Britain to Europe. And he says he goes to dislodge it from the net with a spade. He hits it with a spade and he hears a really kind of hard, not quite metallic clink, but he hits something solid, breaks this moor log open in half, and there's a whole barbed antler point sitting in there. And the way that Clark talks about this in his PhD, he seems so enamored with it. And I think it's because you've got these excavations going on in other parts of Northwest Europe, especially in Denmark, where they've got this amazing organic material culture and animal bones, that this is what drives him on to find a site that is comparable, if not in material, at least in preservation. And he does a tour and he looks at a few different sites. So when John Moore gets in contact with him, you can realize why he's so excited about this, because it's really something he's been searching for decades. And then to find it at Star Car, there were one or two small excavations that happened before Star Car that had some organic preservation, but not really a lot. And most of those were quite mixed. So it looks like after Mesolithic activity had happened, other things had happened, mixed everything up, which for archaeologists, it makes it really difficult to understand exactly what's going on and exactly how the remains relate to human activity. The joy with Star Car is that all of that material was deposited and left there in the early Mesolithic, as you say, like 11,000 years ago. And then it simply sat there. And it was swallowed up by the peat that's forming in the lakes. And then it was only when Graham Clark went back in the 1940s that it saw the light of day again. And that is, in archaeology terms, we describe that as in situ. So something that has remains where it is since it was left there by people in whatever period we're studying. And that is the context which gives us most information, because we can not just say what it is, where it might be from, we can also start thinking about why people are doing certain things in certain places, what that might mean in terms of their daily lifestyle or their seasonal activities or their life ways. So really, it absolutely opened the door on saying brand new things about this period, which just stone tools on their own didn't. And of course, we had animal bones and we had organic material, and there was wood at Starkar as well, which let Graham Clark start saying things about the species that people were hunting, the amount of different species people were hunting, maybe those species that people weren't hunting as much, maybe the different ways that animals were being used. And then it started to get him thinking about what it means in terms of where humans were going in the landscape, or maybe where they weren't, what their hunting practices might have looked like, what their seasonal lifestyles might have looked like. Were they going to certain places at certain times of the year? And Graham Clark suggested that red deer were probably going to be seasonally migrational at that period of time. So he then suggested that maybe people in the Mesolithic were following red deer around the landscape during the year. Now, more recently, we think that that's probably not the case, because red deer that live in forested environments tend to stay in the forest year round. So although not everything that he said was necessarily what we think today, what was amazing is that he was really pushing the boundaries of what could be said about people's lives in the past using this organic material. And it was a watershed moment for the way that we study animal bones in archaeology. It's one of the moments that gives birth to the study of zooarchaeology, which is the archaeological study of animal bones. Before that, a lot of the time, animal bones were looked at by zoologists, not zooarchaeologists. So it's an amazing sight that not only expands our understanding of the period, it has a really pivotal moment in the development of the study of prehistoric archaeology in Britain and more broadly. So it's super important.
Super important. And we'll definitely delve into those animal bones in due course. We mentioned words there such as early Mesolithic and post-Ice Age, but very quickly, Nick, just a bit of an addition to that. What do we mean when we say the word Mesolithic?
So Mesolithic is a period name that we use as archaeologists to kind of split up the past into usable chunks. So it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody in the Mesolithic was the same. We're not thinking about a single identity. We're not even thinking necessarily that they're genetically all the same. What we're talking about is a period of time. And that period of time is from the end of the last ice age, so broadly around about 9,500 BC. And then in Britain, the Mesolithic ends when the Neolithic begins. And so the Neolithic arrives in Britain around about 4,000 BC, maybe slightly earlier, where we get our earliest, what we would describe as typically Neolithic, and I'm using air quotes here, Neolithic technology. So we're looking at domestic plants, domestic animals, the first pottery. These are the kind of signatures of Neolithic activity. So these come in just before 4,000 BC. So the Mesolithic is a period of time. It's, you know, 5,500 years long. And what's amazing is that you think the length of time between the start and the end of the Mesolithic, so 9,500 BC to 4,000 BC, is almost the same length of time from the start of the Neolithic to now. So it's an expansive period of time. It's huge. And we are seeing groups of humans. They have organic materials, so that we're looking at material culture made of bone and antler. We're seeing things made out of wood, having them use things made out of maybe skin and furs and bark and plant textile materials. But because of preservational issues, you know, it's a long period of time for these very delicate things to survive. We haven't got any physical evidence of things like plant textiles or skin. But given the fact that they don't have ceramics at that time, they don't have metals. So you can imagine that organic materials played a really, really important part in their material culture and their daily life. And so there are no domestic plants, no domestic animals. So we would describe them as living a life way that is hunter, fisher, gatherer. So they're moving around the landscape, maybe using a patchwork or a network or a mosaic of different sites that allow you to do different kinds of things, gather different kinds of plant materials, both nutritionally and for kind of material culture, different places that have different animal species living there, some of which you're going to be hunting, some of which you're maybe not going to be hunting, some of which you're going to be hunting larger numbers, some smaller numbers. It depends entirely on what they're using them for. So you can see groups moving around networks of places doing all of these kinds of activities.
Well, hunter, fisher, gatherers after the Ice Age, and it's fascinating, therefore, that Starkar dates to this very early period in the Mesolithic in Britain. I mean, Barry, if you visit Starkar today, I must admit, I've never been in person. You have to invite me up one day. I have to have a look. But it looks quite, I mean, lots of fields in the Vale of Pickering in Yorkshire. But 11,000 years ago, roughly 9,000 BC, what do we think this whole landscape, this whole environment looks like? Would it have looked very different?
Yeah, completely. So like you say, the modern landscape is an agricultural landscape. It sits on the eastern end of a large valley. So we've got the North York Moors on one side, the Yorkshire Wolds on the other side, not far from the coast. And it's very sort of flat and it looks quite a featureless landscape. And essentially, it's a drying out peat bog. So the last few hundred years, it's been increasingly drained to bring into agricultural usage. If we go back to the Mesolithic, so if we're looking at Starkar, around about 9,300 roughly is the earliest activity there. By that point, the landscape is dominated by this enormous lake, which we call Lake Flixton. The lake's about 5 kilometres long, about 2.5 kilometres wide. So it's a really substantial body of water. There's a couple of islands in the lake. And then the lake shore is this really sort of complex arrangement of low hills, peninsulas and sort of lagoons that are sort of branching off and feeding into the area around the shore. And you've probably got a few centuries between the start of the Mesolithic and the very end of the Ice Age. So in that time, the climate warmed very, very quickly and plants recolonised the landscape, they recolonised the lake. So certainly by the time Mesolithic humans were present at Starkar, you've got really extensive areas of reed beds and sedge beds, really rich mosaic of wetlands that are forming around the sort of the shallow lake margins. You've got plants like water lilies and pond weeds and water milfoils in the deeper parts of the lake. And then as you go up onto the water's edge, you've got trees like willow, aspen growing right on the lake shore. And then it's expanding out into, as you go onto the drier ground, into a forest which is predominantly birch. So birch with some willow and aspen forming the main components of the forest itself. Everyone knows what a birch tree is. You know, they're not like oaks. They're not these massive canopy forming trees. They've got quite small branches, quite small leaves. So they create a really open type of woodland environment. There's lots and lots of light reaching the woodland or the forest floor. And so you get lots of ferns, you get lots and lots of understory vegetation, you get some small shrub species growing in amongst that. So you've got this developing forest. So the forest develops over probably within another couple of hundred years of people being at Starkar. So there's a lot of trees there, and then the forest is becoming more expansive. These massive areas of sort of wetlands that are forming around the edge of the lake. So really, really different to now. And then that environment changes throughout the Mesolithic. So what happens is all those plants that are growing in the lake, as they die, the plant material starts to decompose. But it doesn't decompose fully. It starts to accumulate within and around sort of the lake basin. So inside the lake, or the base of the lake, or under the water, you start to get this organic material accumulating, and gradually that turns into this deposit that we call peat. And that makes essentially the lake gradually get shallower and it gets smaller. So it's most pronounced around the edges of the lake. So as these peat deposits build up, the lake gets shallower around its edges. It gradually gets shallower within the basin. The edges of the lake start to terrestrialize. So what would have been open water with reed beds in it when people first arrived at Starkar, by the time people leave Starkar, which is about 800 years later, those deposits around the lake edge are now building up above the level of the water. You've got trees, or particularly willow trees, growing in on what would have been areas of reed swamp. The reed swamp is then shifting into the basin, and the lake's gradually contracting. And then through the course of the Mesolithic, that carries on until the lake is no longer there. And it's just this huge, really rich, expansive wetland. And at the same time as that's happening, during the time people are at Starkar, what would have been the dry ground around the shore also starts to waterlog. So the buildup of these sediments at the lake edge starts to make the area around the lake shore get damper. And then peat forming environments start to expand over the dry ground. So the peat has not only infilled the lake, but it's also buried much of the Mesolithic landscape. So when you go there today, you really just see these sort of humps and bumps around the landscape. And they would have been islands and peninsulas and little hills around the lakes and things like that. But yeah, if you go back to the early part of the Mesolithic, you get this massive lake. And then it's just this very long history of the lake gradually infilling, a process that we call hydroseral succession. And that just brings a whole load of different sort of environments into the lake. And then at the same time as that happens, towards the end of the time that people are at Starkar, we start seeing hazel trees arrive. So Hazel, I suppose they've been hanging out in more the sort of southern parts of Europe, particularly sort of the end of the last ice age, you get these refugia of trees that don't particularly like very cold climates. Birch is quite hardy, so colonises northern Europe first. And then by the time people are abandoning Starkar, we're starting to see hazel trees, maybe a little bit of ash in the landscape. There's some beech trees. And then during the latter part of the Mesolithic, we get the broadleaf deciduous species. So the trees that we're familiar with as forming forests in Britain today. So that's when we get oak, elm, ash and lime. And towards the latter, sort of second part of the Mesolithic, they start to dominate the forest. So the birch woodland that we have in the very early Mesolithic disappears and is replaced by this really dense, really quite dark, broadleaf deciduous forest. So it's a period of really sort of dynamic environmental change. We've got these successions of different plant communities that are coming into northern Europe. The climate's still quite unstable. We see various climatic fluctuations at the time as well. That's obviously affecting animal populations. So certainly before people arriving at Starkar, but after the end of the last ice age, you've got herds of wild horse in the landscape. They seem probably to have gone extinct by the start of the Mesolithic, maybe into the early Mesolithic. You get other species, so there would have been reindeer towards the end of the last ice age. We don't have them in the Mesolithic. And then the species that we would have, their behaviour starts to change as the environment changes. So it's this really sort of dynamic, changing period that humans are living at sites like Starkar.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How did Hitler's sexuality shape his worldview? Why did the Black Death lead to the rise of the witch trials? And what are some of the sauciest scandals involving kings and queens at Hampton Court? I don't know about you, but this is the history I want to hear about. If you do too, then join me, Kate Lister, every Tuesday and Friday to find out the answers to all of these questions and more. Listen to Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
So these humans are living at the site of Starkar, with all of these various fauna and various types of vegetation there. And you mentioned all of this woodlands that would have been there too, Barry. Or Nick, whoever wants to come in with this, because I'd like to ask, therefore, keeping on wood, normally when we think of like great structures of deep in prehistory, maybe we think of the massive monumental stone buildings of the Neolithic or something like Stonehenge or Orkney. But do we have any evidence for quite sizable structures from Starkar, from where these people were living?
Yeah, so if we go back to Clark's excavations, Clark excavates what he describes as the brushwood platform. So it's a load of branches and birch trees that have been cut off the sides of trees and then thrown down into the lake to form like an occupation surface at the wetlands. When we did the larger scale excavations at Starkar, one of the things we discovered is that his brushwood platform is actually just a natural accumulation of wood. It's just literally branches from trees that have fallen in. But what we did find was a series of really substantial wooden trackways or platforms. There's three main ones. There's an early one. There's actually four. There's an early sort of precursor, which looks like it's lots and lots of wood that's been put down onto the base of the lake at the lake margins, probably in order to sort of stabilize the sediments so that people can walk out and access areas of deeper water. There's lots of unusual deposition take place around that. Then a few centuries later, we get the first of three massive timber platforms. The first one is really enormous. I mean, we excavated, I think, about a 12-meter stretch of it, and it showed no sign of ending at the edge of our trench. It was a really huge thing. It was two layers of split wood. So people had taken whole tree trunks. They'd driven wedges into them in order to split them even to halves or into quarters. And they'd laid these down. Then there was a layer of whole trees that was sort of laid down diagonally over the top of it. And then another layer of split wood on top of that. Now, when we excavated it, obviously it had thousands of years of peat compressing it down. But even when we excavated, it must have been almost a foot thick in places.
Nick is nodding profusely at that, so it seems in agreement.
It was a chunky thing. But yeah, in the Mesolithic, that must have been a very, very big structure. And from the radiocarbon dating, we know it's built in one phase. So it's not accumulated. It's been built like that. And like I say, that's going off from the shore at an angle, seems to be heading into open water. And it's huge. And that's the first of three major wooden platforms or trackways that are built. The two others are built sort of after the first one goes out of use, we get the second one, then a third one built maybe another sort of 100 years later. They're also quite large. They're not as big as the central one. When you just think, I suppose, of the amount of effort that that takes, I can't quite remember off the top of my head how many trees were just in the excavated bit, but I think it's like sort of 25 or something like that. It might be less, but it's a large number of trees had to be felled just to build the section that we excavated. And that's a communal feat that involved people coming together and working together to do that. And when you think that it's not just the people that are felling the trees and people are having to drag these things through areas of woodland. One thing that's interesting is they're not utilising the trees that are growing at the edge of the lake. Trees at the edge of the lake have got quite a twisted grain. They've got lots of side branches. So Mike Bamford, that did all the wood analysis, he showed that there's a difference in the types of trees that were growing at the edge of the lake to the ones that they use for making the platforms. So they're having to go into areas of fairly dense tree cover to find trees that are growing very straight, that don't have lots of side branches on them. They're undoubtedly felling them. We don't have much direct evidence of felling, but yeah, unless the trees walked into the lake, they must have been felling these trees. They're dragging these things through into the wetlands and then laying these things out as a structure. You'd also have to have people supporting that as well. You know, you've got all the other people that would be involved in that. Yeah, maybe getting the food together and making stuff. You've got the people that are making the tools. This is a community event. And it's not the sort of thing that we've generally associated with the Mesolithic. It's usually something we've associated with the Neolithic. And I think part of that comes back to our way we think about hunter-gatherers. There is this perception, and it dates back to our own colonial past, our encounters with hunter-gatherer groups, and a European sort of view of hunter-gatherers that saw them as relatively simple. Simple in terms of that they didn't have a particularly complicated social hierarchy, or they weren't thought to possess a complicated social hierarchy. They were seen as maybe not having much in the way of ideas of sort of ownership. Everything was seen to be communal. There was this idea that hunter-gatherers were just egalitarian and that they lived in quite small groups. And this was despite the fact that Europeans were encountering and seeing large monumental architecture made by hunter-gatherers in Australia and different parts of continental North America. But they just conveniently ignored this or put it down to some sort of lost race of Europeans or something like that. There was just this idea that hunter-gatherers just weren't up to the job of that sort of communal activity. So when we thought about the European Mesolithic, those ideas have obviously filtered through. And so there's always been this idea that social complexity, communal monumental architecture is something that only comes in the Neolithic with farming. But clearly it's there right at the start of the Mesolithic at Starkar. And that's one of the great things about Starkar. It's not just a Mesolithic site that shows us this. It's the earliest Mesolithic site in the country that shows us this. People are right at the start of the Mesolithic, have this, I don't want to use the term complex, but they are clearly up to the job of large communal structures coming together in large groups. Yeah, however you want to interpret what that means in terms of their society. And then you think about why they're building the structures as well. These structures come in as the lake is starting to infill around the edges. And so it's getting boggier. Whereas right at the beginning of the Mesolithic, you'd just be able to wade out through water. By this point, you're probably sort of squelching through a fair bit of this really organic-y sludge. It's harder to access areas of open water. And you can see these platforms as really as a way of investing in this place as well. Because another preconception of hunter-gatherers is that they're always highly mobile. They just move from place to place. And they are mobile. But there's always been this idea that Mesolithic people were quite fleeting. Yeah, they had no permanent structures. They just move from place to place without really leaving much of a trace. And what we see at Starkar, it's a massive investment in the ability to stay at that one place. So they've already been there several centuries, and then they just build these enormous wooden structures where a community comes together and basically says, we want to stay here despite the fact the local environment is changing. We will invest this communal effort in order to allow that.
That is all just so amazing. As you say, it's so rare to have these significant structures surviving pre the Neolithic period, but you do have them there. But Nick, I've got to ask also about some of the artifacts, and we hinted at them earlier. This bone, this antler. Antler artifacts, first of all, there seems to have been an abundance of antler objects found from Starkar.
Yeah, there are. And it's worth saying that in the following 70 plus years since Starkar's been excavated, there's been no other site in Britain excavated that's got such a large assemblage of animal bones and of bone and antler artifacts from this period. So we've got other sites that are adding to that assemblage, but Starkar is by far and away the jewel in the crown in terms of like numbers of these artifacts. And in some cases, it's the only place where we're finding some of these artifact types as well. So we've got two of the main bone and antler artifacts that really kind of typify Starkar, the barbed antler points, and then we've got the red deer frontlets, which Barry mentioned as well. So we'll take the points first. So the barbed antler points, in order to make these, you're getting your whole red deer antlers. And we see at Starkar, we have a mixture of shed and unshed antlers. So some of them are still attached to parts of the skull. Some of them appear to have been dropped by the stag. So this is quite helpful because it tells us what time of year people might be at that site, depending on whether the animal was holding its antlers when it was killed or whether the antler fell off. Although there's some arguments to suggest that maybe we're looking at people collecting antler throughout the year and then maybe doing this at particular times. So it gives us an idea when people are knocking around the environment. And then what you do is you take one of your flint tools and you carve two parallel lines down the length of the beam. So the main long bit of the antler, which all of the points, the tines come off. You carve these two lines down it and you keep on carving them. And from experience, both Barry and I have done this experimentally to sort of reconstruct some of these. You carve and you carve and you carve, and it can take 4 or 5 hours to get two parallel grooves that run all the way through the solid outer wall of the antler into the spongy central material in the antler. And then you cut at each end. So you try and do the same thing with two short parallel lines at each end of your splinter. And then you wedge the tines into the grooves and lever your splinter out. So then you have a lovely, long, relatively straight splinter of red deer antler. And then these have been shaped. So they're pointed at one end, more kind of rounded at the other end. And then there are a series of barbs or teeth carved into just one side. So the technical description of these are uniserial barbed antler points because they only have barbs on one side, hence the uniserial. So just one side. And then at Starkar, we have some that are quite short, so maybe only 10 centimetres. Some which are very long. I think the longest one is over 40 centimetres in length. Some of them have barbs very, very close together. Some of them have barbs very well spaced. So sometimes they're 4 or 5 centimetres apart. And I think this suggests that maybe these are multi-purpose objects. So they are potentially being used for fishing. So we know in other sort of ethnographic accounts, so of hunter-gatherer groups that are living in contemporary areas in the world, you can see that maybe two or more of the barbed antler points are mounted at the end of a spear or a stick with the barbs facing towards each other. And then you can stab it onto a fish or in particular an eel, and the points go on either side of the eel. And then because of the teeth, it kind of holds the eel in place and you can pull it out. So they are what are known as leisters, so fishing leisters. But these may also be being used for hunting big game. So they may be being placed on either spears or arrows and used to hunt the large mammals that are living in the Mesolithic. They may also be being used, I think that they're probably going to be quite handy for hunting birds as well. The idea that you could maybe fire them on the end of an arrow and the barbs will get caught in the wing structure. So it wouldn't maybe kill a bird, but it would definitely bring them down. So then you could go and retrieve them and kill them. So I think the variation in size and shape and different barbs, it might be something about different people making them in different ways. So it might be an expression of identity, skill, but it might also be partly about the particular things that they're trying to do with them as well.
Nick, before we go on a bit further on that,
sure.
You mentioned something really interesting there, which is like the hunting of birds. So do we have evidence that these early Mesolithic people were also using ranged weapons, such as a bow and arrow too?
Yeah, absolutely. So from across Northwest Europe, we've got quite a lot of good evidence for bow and arrow. And in some very lucky cases, we actually have preserved bows or fragments of bows. So there are bows from wetland sites in Scandinavia. There is a small bow recovered from Star Car as well.
Wow.
But there is difference in some of these. So some of them look really quite big. So some of the bows from Scandinavia look like they have quite a substantial draw weight. And these would certainly give you enough power. So people have done experimental work on the power and the penetration of arrows from different types of bows. And some of the Mesolithic bows are definitely powerful enough to hunt big game. So to deliver a lethal blow to the largest of the mammal species that live in the Mesolithic. The one from Starkar is quite a lot smaller. And so it may be that we're looking at a lightweight bow that is used for things like maybe hunting birds. You can imagine an arrow with a barbed point on being used to bow hunt for fish, maybe. So standing on one of these lovely wooden platforms that Barry described, waiting for the fish to come in and then hunting them like that. And we also have one of the stone tools that typifies the Mesolithic, known as a microlith. So this is a small flint blade. So a blade is anything that is parallel sided and is twice as long as it is wide or more. And then the microlith, you take your blade and then you snap it in one or more places and then you retouch it. So you take tiny little removals off that snap to basically make small points. And we've got evidence of lots of microliths found in the same place. And again, in Scandinavia, where the Mesolithic is always even more dramatic than we get in Britain, we actually have some examples where you're seeing multiple microliths that are actually hafted into a wooden arrow shaft and they're held there with pine or some form of tree resin. And in that case, we're seeing some have two, so a microlith for the point and then a microlith at the side for a barb. But in one case, we actually have an arrow which has five microliths in, one for the point and then two barbs on each side. So the idea that we have this microlithic technology, which is being used to make composite projectile points. So you can use them and then if you miss or like if you lose a microlith, you can just simply make another microlith and pop it back in and then you have a functioning arrow again. So we've got quite a lot of evidence to say that they are using bows and arrows. And then there is some evidence that they're using bigger things as well. So some of the points that we're getting, particularly, so again, on the continent, some of the bone points that you get are simply too big, too heavy to be functional on an arrow. So that would suggest that they're being used on a spear. And in some really rare cases, we actually have some animal bones that exhibit the marks of weapons that have been used to kill them. And there's a very famous example. Well, there's actually a couple of examples in Denmark, two aurochs, so these big prehistoric cows. And they've actually got big puncture holes in their scapula, in their shoulder blade, which suggests that they've been killed like a final coup de grace, a final killing blow by some big spear or pole. And in one case, there's actually a hole in both scapula. One side, the spear is coming from the outside, so from the external side of the body. But in the other scapula, the hole has been made from the inside. So basically that is a spear that has been run straight the way through the animal. And you can imagine that's quite a dramatic final blow for maybe quite a dramatic hunt. So yeah, although we have these problems with the fact that the period is a long time ago, a lot of sites don't have organic preservation, so we only have partial remains here and there. We still have an amazing amount of information. When you look at it in really forensic detail, we have a lot of information that allows us to start seeing those parts of people's lives that are maybe missing at most sites. We can piece it together.
Nick, I have to ask one more question on the bones and antlers before we move on to an overview, a bit of a wrap-up of other artifacts and then a wrap-up of Starkar. You kind of hinted at earlier these frontlets, because these just look absolutely extraordinary. And well, what do we think their function was as well?
So this is like the million-dollar question.
Good.
This is exactly the kind of reason that I think we get into archaeology, because it's these enigmatic artifacts that really light a fire in people to think more about life in the past. So what these are, you need to imagine you've got a red deer skull. It's a male red deer. It's still got the antlers attached. So you've got the top of the skull, and then you've got the face and the nose projecting down in the front. We then see that they're intentionally trimming and removing parts of the skull. So a lot of the brain case, the lower portion of the back of the skull that holds the brain, and all of the front of the skull is taken off. So we're left with just the forehead and then the very top of the skull where the antlers attach. So you can imagine this portion of the skull, and then the antlers themselves go through a process of trimming. So they are taking quite a lot of these antlers. So the crown, so that's the big spiky bit right at the top, the crown is taken off. The beams are thinned down, so some of them are half sectioned. So they like making a barbed antler point, carving those grooves in, but instead of creating two grooves quite closely together to create a splinter, they're doing it on each side of the beam and actually removing one side of the beam. So then you have a partial set of antlers, which are maybe halved or hollowed out, maybe with some of the biggest examples have got one or two tines. Sometimes they've just got small portions of antler left. And these, from experimental work that people have done, this process takes an extensive amount of time to turn a skull into one of these frontlets. Then some of them have perforations, so extra holes added. Some of them are in the front of the frontlet, some of them are in the side, some of them have absolutely no perforations at all. And I think this is quite an important thing, is to not think that they are all exactly the same. I think a total of 21 have been recovered from Starkar. And that's particularly important because to date, no others have been found at any Mesolithic site in Britain. And that's kind of why Starkar becomes such an infamous site of this period. There are a few other sites in Europe that have artifacts that you might describe as frontlets as well, so modified skulls of red deer. But again, there is variation in what they look like. Some of them have trimmed antlers, some of them have no antlers. So at Starkar, we've got a couple of examples where we've got that trimmed skull, but the antlers are either entirely gone, or in one case, it's a female and there were no antlers anyway. Some have full sets of antlers, some have perforations, some don't. So when Graham Clark found, I think 17 of them came out of Graham Clark's excavations, something around that number, including one with two intentional perforations in the front of the frontlet. So you imagine, like, basically on the top of the deer skull. And it's really enigmatic because it looks like a mask, you know, two big perforations sitting on the top of that frontlet. And you can almost imagine somebody wearing it on their head, maybe even looking out through those holes. Some of them have perforations on the side, which again may relate to it being tied to somebody's head, and they regularly get described as headdresses. And so obviously, as soon as you start describing something as a headdress, it kind of has an inherent interpretation that people are wearing them on their heads. So there's a chance that people are wearing them on their heads. And if they are, that might be one of a number of reasons. People have suggested that maybe they're being used as hunting disguises. So there is some evidence of hunter-gatherer groups in other parts of the world using costumes made out of the skin and the skulls of prey animals, and you actually wrap yourself in these and then go out hunting. And the idea that is camouflage to allow you to get closer to a prey that you want to hunt. Another suggestion is that these are actually artifacts that are related to the ontology, so the worldview of people, or some people describe it as the religious views of people in the Mesolithic. And in particular, people sometimes describe these headdresses as relating to shamanism. So shamanism is a particular religion that is recorded in particularly Siberian hunter-gatherer groups in the 18th and 19th century by anthropologists. And then as Western anthropology goes out and meets more hunter-gatherer groups in different parts of the world, more groups are kind of classified as shamanistic in their kind of religion or their worldview. And the basic premise of shamanism is the idea that these people live in a world that was full of different sentient, capable intentional living things. So in the way that we see humans as being sentient and intentional and full of emotion and the capability to act and react and think, groups that practice shamanism, and this is part of a broader set of practices that are known as animism, the idea that many things in the world are animate. So it's not just humans, actually lots of animal species, lots of plant species, weather, geological formations, lakes, all these kinds of things have the potential to be animate. So to be intentional, thinking, acting things. And this is a really core component of shamanism, because that means that if you and that deer over there are inherently similar in your abilities and practices, some groups that practice shamanism believe that because you're inherently similar, you can also either engage in negotiations with other species. So you can talk or you can negotiate your kind of standing with them. Or in some cases, you can even actually transform yourself from one species into another. And these transformations can be really dangerous, as you can imagine, like the fear of turning into a deer or a beaver or an otter and then getting stuck in that state can be like a real anxiety in shamanistic practices. So some of these groups have ritual specialists, and these are shamans. And these ritual specialists are the people that commune with non-human spirits, non-human beings in the landscape, and at times even go through these transformational processes. And Graham Clark, when he found these frontlets at Starkar, became really enamored. There's a picture in his 1954 publication of Starkar of a shaman from a group called the Evenki in Siberia. And this shaman has got this big, elaborate dress sort of garb on. He's holding a big drum and he's got a pair of frontlets on the top of his head. And so Graham Clark, in his interpretation, says maybe it's a hunting disguise. Maybe it's something like this. Maybe it's something related to ritual or religious practice. And so other people have kind of picked up on this and have suggested that these artifacts are about a negotiation between human relationships and their relationships with other species. So maybe some of them are being worn, but maybe those perforations are also about mounting these. So maybe they're being hung in trees, mounted on posts around the site. The other thing that kind of makes me think that the headdress isn't a suitable interpretation for all of them is that not all of them have perforations. So I think some of them would be very difficult to wear. Some of them don't have antlers. The variety of practices that we see there, I think, points to a more subtle and more complicated practice. People at Starkar seem to be really interested in the heads of animals, particularly red deer, but not only red deer. They're also doing interesting depositional practices with other species. And I think we are seeing practices where people are following particular rules of engagement with the remains of particular animal species, maybe even particular animal individuals. Like, I think the really important thing with the red deer, like if you go to a place where there are red deer populations, you talk to people that are familiar with them, like the rangers or people go there regularly, they recognize the stags based on their antler pattern, you know, how many spikes they have, what particular shapes they are. So I think the antlers are a really powerful way for people to recognize particular individual animals. So what we're seeing is that the heads of animals that are hunted, that are encountered and engaged with during daily life, people are then taking them, they're affording them a number of different treatments. They are removing parts, they are trimming parts, they are perforating parts in some cases. And then they are going through a process of really intentional deposition. So these are being collated, they're being curated, and they're being put in the edge of the wetland. So that, I think some could be headdresses, some aren't. But I think the way that they're being treated shows that they are part of a broader practice by which people in the Mesolithic are engaged in really complicated and powerful and social relationships with the animals that they share the environment with, and they ultimately hunt and then kill and then have a duty to deal with their remains in a particular way.
Well, there you go. Wow, Nick, round of applause for that. What an explanation indeed. Just literally taken away to shamans and headdresses. Were they headdresses? Were they not? That's absolutely brilliant. I'll come back to you, Barry. We could talk about these artifacts from Starkar and from this area of Yorkshire for hours, no doubt. But to kind of wrap up talking about these artifacts, are there any particular artifacts that you'd like to highlight that you find particularly interesting that deserve a really good mention in the Ancients podcast?
Ooh, so what you're saying is, what's my favourite artifact?
Oh. Well, yeah, okay, go on then.
There's the issue. I could start by the artifact that we still haven't found, and that's the boat. So we're looking at Starkar, we're looking at other sites around the lake. It's a large body of water, it's deep, it's 6 or 7 metres deep in places. The easiest way to move around this landscape would be by boat. We don't have any. Probably because they're made of either a wooden frame with skins on or birch bark. So that would be nice. There's some sites in Scandinavia. So Tibbenvig, for example, in Denmark, has got these dugout canoes. Dugout canoes are probably not an option around Lake Flixton and Starkar because of the types of trees we've got. But they also have these amazing decorated paddles. And again, if I'm going to talk about things that I'd like to find around this landscape, these are absolutely beautiful carved. They're made from the splitting a piece of wood, shaping it so it's really thin, creating beautiful shaped handles, and then they've got this massive heart-shaped blades that are decorated. I think that would be quite nice. One of the interesting things, I think, is that we've got all this organic preservation. We don't find much made of plant material, which is strange. Some of that, I think, is down to preservation bias. So the things that aren't made of wood, so things that might be made of reeds, for example, things might be made of nettle that's been turned into cord that's then turned into some sort of like textile or containers. We don't have those, and that could be preservation. But there's not a huge number of wooden artifacts. We've got these platforms. I think there was over 4,000 pieces of wood that were analysed, over 1,000 of which showed some signs of modifications. And then I think there's 30 artifacts. And it's always struck me that there's a paucity of wooden objects. So we have projectile points. We don't have arrows. For example, we have one bow, we have some digging sticks, but it's a very narrow range of artifacts and it's a very sort of limited number as well. So, it makes you wonder what they're doing that means that they don't preserve. So obviously they treat them differently to the objects made of animal remains. So we're missing some of that plant-based material culture. Yeah, I think my favourite artifacts have to be the ones that aren't there. Boats and paddles, I think, would be fantastic to find. More plant-based material culture. As Nick said, it's a ceramic, there's no pottery. They must have containers, presumably made of birch bark, possibly made of things like reed. We don't really have those. They would be just beautiful to find. And I think more decoration as well. We know from Northern Europe that lots of Mesolithic material culture is decorated, but less so around Starkar. We've got some. There are a few pieces at Starkar that are decorated, really nice decorated shale pendant. Some of the antler as well, some of the antler barb points have got decorations on them. But I think just generally more plant material, more decorated stuff, more art would be nice, I think. There you go. Art on a paddle, that would be perfect.
Art on a paddle, well, there you go. Well, we look forward to hearing when you make that startling discovery in the years ahead, Barry. I guess I've got to ask another very, very quick question to this. So from the archaeology that you've got the platforms, you've got these artifacts. You don't have much organic material apart from the wood, but you've got all these bones and frontlets and so on. Do you think we could potentially say that this is at Starkar, this is an early Mesolithic village? Do we kind of know what the function of it might have been?
It gets really, really tricky to do that thing that archaeologists do of stroking their chin and saying, oh, well, you can't say that. The site's occupied for 8 centuries. It's unlikely that the forms of activity stay the same. It does seem to be particularly intensive in terms of occupation. There are buildings above the shore on the dry ground, so they only survive as post holes, so the holes where the posts of the building would have been. They're reasonably small, but there's a few of those, and I think there's probably a lot more on the site. So people probably live there. I think it's certainly tempting, given that the scale of the site, the intensity of activity there, it's certainly tempting to see it as a sort of focal point in the landscape. I wouldn't have any problem with calling it a settlement. Whether it's occupied all year round is harder to tell. But I think there's no reason to suggest that at least some people that are part of the community aren't there all year round. Maybe some people move to other places at different times. I think the idea of how far away they move from Starkar is also interesting to think about. Like the lake itself is a really, really productive, very rich, economically rich landscape. People probably don't have to travel very far to hunt their fishing, probably fowling, so hunting wild birds as well. Lots and lots of the plants in the area we know from other sites in Mesolithic Europe are used as plant foods. So I don't have a problem with the fact that people are there, that it is essentially, yeah, village would be one way of framing it, you know, a settlement occupied by a reasonably large number of people for the Mesolithic, I think.
Well, it sounds very exciting for the years ahead as you guys uncover more and more and more. And, you know, if they're on that island, surely there must be boats. Surely there'll be a boat somewhere and you will find it, Barry. Keep it there. It's going to happen one day. And I want to know when it happens, okay? Because it's going to be big. It's going to be massive. But guys, this has been absolutely brilliant. Such an amazing insight into one of the greatest archaeological gems in Britain. And it just goes to me to say thank you so much to both of you for taking the time to come on the podcast today.
Thank you very much. It's been great being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, there you go. There was Dr. Nick Overton and Dr. Barry Taylor talking you through the amazing story of Starkar and other Mesolithic sites around the Vale of Pickering. They're some 11,000 years old, and why these sites are a great jewel in the story of British archaeology, revealing more about Britain just after the end of the Ice Age. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. A couple of last things from me. We have a special bonus subscriber episode coming up in the next few weeks where I will answer your questions about the Roman Empire. Any questions you have, you can send us the question via a link in the description. Just check the show notes. That will tell you what you need to do. And alongside that, make sure that wherever you're listening to The Ancients, whether it be on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or elsewhere, make sure that you are subscribed, that you are following The Ancients so that you don't miss out when we release new episodes twice every week. But that's enough from me, and I will see you in the next episode.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Ancients. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code ANCIENTS at checkout.